Blog Talk Radio. Where not just women are in danger, but all marginalized people. Where being uniquely different right now might truly be considered a crime. It seems as though we had all slipped into a false sense of comfort, that justice would prevail and that good would win in the end. Well, good did not win this election, but good will win in the end. So what today means is that we are far from the end. Today marks the beginning of our story. The revolution starts here. The fight for the right to be free, to be who we are, to be equal. Let's march together through this darkness, and with each step, know that we are not afraid. That we are not alone. That we will not back down. That there is power in our unity, and that no opposing force stands a chance in the face of true solidarity. And to our detractors that insist that this march will never add up to anything.
Austin Red here with Friday Java, a weekly magazine of political theory, polling, and commentary. It is part of the history called people that make up this fascinating journey. We are part of the Obama Network. For that, we make no apologies. What we pledge to do is give you the facts on a bridge to history, what body politics is, the most up-to-date theories of political science and psychology. Stay tuned for this incredible ride. Austin Red, peace out.
This is Friday Java on the 1st of February 2019 from WBRN Radio and on the Boston Red Network. This is our magazine program, we call it, and we will have an opportunity to live up to the name today. Also, this is African History Month, the month of February, and we'll have special programming on African history. This particular day was brought to the American nation by Dr. Carter G. Woodson, a historian, and he took an opportunity to present to the nation the advances that African people were making in the nation. It was one day at a time, and yet through an evolutionary process to a whole month, and it's in February now, moving from a Negro History Day to month, and then on to Black History Month in the 70s, and now we have the African History Month. We'll start out here with something that has been on the mind of many. It's called a polar vortex. We'll fall back on the New York Times. A closer look at the polar vortex, dangerously cold winds. Chicago will be as cold as the Arctic on Wednesday. This article, incidentally, was written on the 31st of January, and we'll go to Chicago in a minute. Temperatures will plummet to a minus 26 degrees of Fahrenheit in Chicago and a minus 31 in Madison, Wisconsin. On Wednesday night, the worst cold has gripped the upper Midwest in a generation. Parts of Alaska, and on the other hand, are unseasonably warm. what is causing the extreme cold across the United States, the polar vortex, an ominous sounding a system of wind and cold air over the North Pole, broke apart this month, and here's how it's bringing a dangerously cold to the nation. The vortex spins to life every winter 10 miles above the ground, seen on the 22nd of December. Typically, it has a single center surrounded by a wall of powerful winds, but sometimes it weakens and shifting and even breaks into pieces. We put this on our Facebook page, and it shows it actually spinning around and splitting into pieces here. Very good. You can find it on Facebook, on our Facebook page. Then the cold arrives. The split takes 2 weeks to affect the weather pattern. It warps the polar jet stream and bringing freezing Arctic air south and warms the air in the north. Parts in the Midwest were expected on Tuesday night to have a wind chill of minus 60 degrees. Dr. Cohen says extreme weather could continue for 6 to 8 weeks after the spin. The effects of the polar vortex could become more frequent and severe. Scientists looking at links between climate change and the polar vortex believe that the rapid warming Arctic could bring about more intense periods of cold snaps and storms than ever as the winter becomes shorter and warmer. So this is some of the information we have here. Have it spinning around. Let's go out to the Windy City, Chicago. Record for the coldest temperatures ever fall as a polar vortex has the city in its crosshair. This is from the Chicago Tribune. On the 30th of January, one of the coldest air masses in years will envelop the Midwest and the Northeast this weekend, bringing periodic life-threatening low temperatures to Chicago. The coldest temperatures of the year will arrive midweek by early Wednesday, plummeted to 23 below. Thursday morning will tumble from to minus 26, matching Chicago's coldest temperature ever recorded on January the 20th. 1985. The coldest daytime high in Chicago was minus 11 on Christmas Eve 1983. For Generation Z, Chicago was born since the 90s. The burst of Arctic air set to overtake the city this week could be the coldest day of their lives, and only rival it is the minus 19 in February 3rd of 1996. And let me move along here. The wintry onslaught that will be driven by the northern hemisphere's polar vortex, which we just described. The temperatures rise in the Arctic and the polar jet stream, the torrent of westerly winds that hold the polar vortex in place can weaken and, of course, split, as the other article said. And let's see, what else do we have here? Temperatures continue with wind. It could lead to the onset of frostbite in less than 30 minutes. In some areas, they did, in fact, have a frostbite. Let me go over here and we'll go to the dangerous deep freeze is the article on, I guess, what would be the front page of the Tribune. And let's go to Ed. Zero is going to feel good, no doubt about it. This is on the 31st. This would have been January the 31st. It was an all-time record. It wasn't even as cold as the day before. but the polar vortex held northern Illinois in an ice grip for the second straight day, made of extremely unpleasant and dangerous conditions across Illinois and northwest Indiana. The mercury plunged to 21 degrees below zero. That was on Thursday at O'Hare Airport. 2 degrees warmer than on Wednesday. And that's a record was set in 1985. I was surprised when I walked outside. My face hurt. That is from Nick Dulini. Hopefully we got his name right. Away from the lake, the temperatures were even colder. Aurora logged in minus 32. Rockford, Illinois, down closer to going 31 below zero. Health officials at least one coal-related death. A hospital in the central part of the state as a result of a deep freeze. And some people died in garages all over the place. The face freezing cold coupled with a day-long polar vortex snap that descended upon the Midwest. That was on Monday night that it started out. And some of the electrical operations had problems. They had problems in Michigan and problems in Wisconsin and Illinois. Now, the Salvation Army Shelter of Hope facility that's in Humboldt Park. This is not just bad weather. It could be considered, as we look at, a public health risk. No doubt about that. The mayor delivered donuts to water crews and visited with mechanics. And one of the things that was on NPR, they were talking about the setting of fire of tracks. They had to be hand switched. These are the rail tracks on the subway trains in Chicago. Water supplies such as 50-pound bags of rock salt, space heaters, some of the instruments of destruction of that were used. Let me now go to the upper Midwest. We'll go to Minnesota and see what we can see, as they say. Evidently, what, Neil Young was in town. Oh, boy. Bitter cold shows reliable energy sources are critical. No doubt about that. I don't think this is an advertisement for nuclear power. We'll be going with that. But looking at the paper, it's minus one in the Twin Cities of Minnesota. And what else do we have here? Usually headlines of climatic conditions make it the front. No doubt about that. The front pages, we can usually see that happening. We don't see it here. We'll probably have to go to NPR to find it. I assume that we would have it on the front pages. But we don't. What we have is an article on, and we'll talk about this tomorrow night, Iowa Democrats weigh Amy Klobuchar, she's a senator from Minnesota's presidential ambitions. There's also an article by George Will on Amy Klobuchar. I don't know if we'll have time to get to it for whatever reason. We're not... there are times you don't get... what you expect. As I said, minus one, back to zero today, finally, is a headline here. And I think over the weekend, I know in Chicago, the temperature is going to be up in the high 30s and perhaps 40s. Some observer in a place called Cotton, Minnesota, the temp measured minus 56 Fahrenheit this morning. The next coldest was, and I don't even try to pronounce this one, more than 340 daily lows, minuses, and 340 maximum. High temperatures were broken. Our records tied in the Midwest in this Arctic situation that flew into the upper Midwest on Friday morning. Will start another sub-zero type of high, and looking at some highs, it'll be 37 in Bismarck and 42 in Pierre. That's in South Dakota. And what else do we see here? Northern Minnesota to be 12 degrees, and Green Bay to be 16. Green Bay used to be very, very cold playing football there in Green Bay. It'd be 19 in Milwaukee. Just some of the temperatures are going forward here. So the temps will be at least above zero. We can leave it there, and let's look at the northeast here. We'll turn into the weather channel and see what it is here. Let's see. We got Thirteen degrees right now. Fahrenheit, what's that? It didn't give it Celsius, but so the high today will be 24 in Boston, West, and this part of Massachusetts, and it'll be 35, not as cold on Saturday. We didn't check where the bowl is being played, but we can guess that 13 is not bad to be. Let's go to AccuWeather here. Usually we go to, we'll go to the Weather Channel. We'll do that. 10-day forecast. I think it'd be about the same today, 25, and the low will be 14. This is on the Fahrenheit scale, where the humidity is. And it'll be in the 40s. Actually, on Monday, it'll be 55, and the low will be 29, and in the 40s. Most of next week, So that is above average, at least as I can recall it here. And this is the, what is this, 10-day forecast. And we look at, let's see. This is the Weather Channel owned by none other than IBM. So it's in the 20s, 25, and tomorrow 36 in the 40s, and balmy 55 on Monday. Unbelievable that you can have that kind of thing there. And from the Public News Service, where we're over here, this is out of Columbus, Ohio, the polar vortex has arrived in the Buckeye State, and the Public Utility Commission of Ohio says that that it will keep bills down and save wear and tear on the heating system, and indoor space heaters can provide extra warmth, he said, and can be only use it with caution. That's for sub-zero degrees weather there. And let me back to the Midwest. Sometimes I want to be in the Midwest. To Wisconsin. Wisconsin, don't have anything on the, but we do on the Foxconn facility. We'll do it while we're here. Then we'll go to the people at the University of Virginia. Nonetheless, Foxconn, those are the people we're going to build a facility that would create 13,000 jobs in Wisconsin. Racine County was where it would be located. These were going to be quote-unquote factory workers of blue-collar jobs. Now they switch to engineers is what they'll be doing, but the plan evidently still poses. It's a massive 20 million square foot complex. And it's, that was going to be its manufacturing plant for mobile phone screens, laptops, which they don't sell as many anymore. We're starting to look at watershed. This is the Des Plaines River. This is on the Erie, very close to Illinois. Nonetheless, they were supposed to get $4 billion on the deal. And we'll see where that goes. Boss Walker claims they won't get any money unless they absolutely would deserve it. Now to Larry Sabatow, and as we normally do, we remember a Hebehire who was killed by white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia, the home of the University of Virginia. Anyway, oh, we go here. This is Larry Sabatow's crystal ball, he called it. The guest here is Theodore Arrington, S. Arrington. He is a cephologist, a political scientist that specializes in House elections. The title here is Seats, Votes, Relations in a U.S. House, 1972 to 2018. The key points here, after adjusting results for uncontested races, Democrats won the national popular vote by 7 points last fall. The size of the Democrats' national win allows them to translate their share of the vote into a roughly approximate share of seats. House maps in the 70s and in the 80s exhibited a pro-Democratic bias. Most recently, maps have a pro-Republican bias. The Koch brothers are much responsible for that. Redistricting in the U.S. House of Representatives is not a unified process, as is the case for most national legislatures. But the results of the cumulative action in the states that have more than one representative, some of these states only have one representative, and that comes to North Dakota, Montana, I believe, and does South Dakota have one also? I believe so, yeah. One common used method for analyzing the partisan nature of redistricting process is the seat-vote relation. We looked at a little bit of it for a longer discussion of the seat-vote. I think we... wait a minute. No, okay. This is a little bit different here, and I guess we won't have time to do it. This is at... yeah. We'll have to look this article up. But nonetheless, how partisan seat voting relationship in the U.S. Congress changed in four reapportionment cycles since the 70s is the title of the article. And this is by Theodore Arrington on the 20th of April, 2010. Okay, let's see here. The 1990 redistricting cycle did not give Republicans an unfair advantage in the seat-vote relationship nationwide or in the southern states, but it may have reduced previous Democratic bias. The 2000 cycle may have given the GOP a slight advantage, and most districting cycles with affirmative districts have increased both the responsiveness of a congressional election and the number of opposed contests. And so we're back here, Dr. Arrington here. Determining percentage of two-party vote received by the Democratic candidates for their House requires attention to two questions. The first question is how the county election in states that have majority vote requirements with runoffs after November. That is Louisiana. Now, Louisiana is a jungle primary, but they do have a runoff. And the elections in which at all candidates in the, excuse me, the jungle primary. Now, jungle primary is in Louisiana, is without parties and, of course, a runoff. Now, that also goes into California and Washington State. We have campaigned against the jungle primaries because we believe a party basis is a much more democratic method of doing things. In California, billionaires and millionaires put together the California, what they call nonpartisan, a jungle primary, where you could have a Republican facing a Republican. This is in the general election. Or you could have a Democrat Republican, but the parties disappear. This makes it much easier for reactionary forces, libertarians, etc., to come forward, and it gives a slant to those people. If the candidate in the final elections are both in the same party, count the contest as unopposed for that party. If there's a runoff after November, I combine the vote of each party's candidate in the November election. In the second question, and we'll append this, is what to do with these and other contests that lack two-party competition. I define an opposed contest as one in which there was both a Democrat and Republican in the November election on the ballot. If the vote is an unopposed contest, is the incumbent the total for that party who has the most unopposed candidates is inflated because of their opponents would have received at least the same vote if the vote of the unopposed candidate is excluded. The vote of the party with the most unopposed candidates is understandable because unopposed candidates would undoubtedly receive a substantial majority of the votes if they were opposed. So now you see exactly what they're talking about here. One way to deal with the problem is to substitute the vote of some other sets of candidates in districts where congressional candidates is unopposed, but on a national basis, the only office available for that job is the presidency. And this is only available in half the congressional districts because the House election is every 2 years while the presidential election is every 4 years. There's a great variation in presidential and congressional voting. That has been historic. There's a possibility that actually it will change in the near future as we now see more people, at least in the last midterm. Usually midterms you have less voters. The last midterm had very robust turnouts that eclipsed the last midterm election in 2014. Now, wait a minute. 2014. And there's a formula here. I won't get into it. D equals the estimate of Democratic vote. R equals the estimate of Republican vote. X is a vote for unopposed Democratic candidates. Y for opposed ones. You can mess around with that. But Gary Jacobson estimates the percentage of the vote that we would expect unopposed candidates would receive on the average if they had been opposed in the formula, and at the 71% would stand a deviation of 10. This analysis is based upon the support that a congressional candidate receives in an election following or preceding the one in which he or she was not opposed. So that's back to the old general theory there. And this is looking at some Democrats here, number of unopposed Democrats, 1972. The total number of major party candidates unopposed, it was 45, incidentally, and 61. So the average for the decade was 60.8, that is from 72 to 80. And from 82 to 1990, in 82, the Democrats had 52 unopposed candidates, Republicans had 13. And we get down to 1990, you see things are changing a little bit here. Democrats had 45 unopposed candidates, the Republicans 37. And there were, 82 here. And from 82 to 1990, 71.6 was the average for the decade. Yeah. Okay. And we go from 1992 to 2000, 54.2 was the average. For Democrats, let's see. The average for the decade was 23.4. And in 2000, there were 33 Democrats unopposed, 31 Republicans. You can see where this is going. And 64 total. We get into 2002. That was, incidentally, the election that was stolen from Al Gore of Tennessee. In 2002, 37 Democrats unopposed, and it was 54. You see the ship coming here, 54 Republicans. 2004, the next race, It was 28 Democrats and 32 Republicans ran unopposed. In 2006, there were 45 Democrats unopposed and just 10 Republicans unopposed. And 2014, 41 Democrats and 36 Republicans unopposed. And in 2016, 35 Democrats, and we don't have any Republicans here. And the average between 2012 and 2008 was 23 here. And in 2018, we had 38 Democrats unopposed and 3 Republicans unopposed. Now, the correlation slope and bias for the entire period for each of the recent redistricting things shows. Anyway, they have a scatter plot here. I can't show you that because I don't have it. But it does talk about 19, with Pearson here, 1972 to 1980, 0.83. And if you slope of the regression line was 2. And solving for 50% of the Democratic vote was 53.3. And then the Democratic vote from 82 to 90 was 56.7. And 92 to 2000 is 53. And 2002 to 2010, 48. And overall, 49.8% here. From 2012 to 2018 showed an enlargement of the Republican bias. If the votes were evenly split, the Democrats would have got 46.6% of the seats on the average at 202 seats out of 435. This pretty well describes what has been happening during this decade. In 2012, the Democrats received 50.6 of the vote adjusted, but only 46.2 of the seats. In 2014, Democrats' percentage of adjusted votes was 47.6, and they won 43.2 in seats. In 2016, Democrats did slightly better with 49.2 of the vote, but still won only 46.6 of the seats. In 18, the Democrats received 53.5% of the vote and won 335 seats. That was 54%. I count this still undecided seat in North Carolina. Anyway, using a regression equation for 12 through 18, the Democrats in 2018 should have received 53.1% of the votes in 230 seats because they received 53.5% of the vote. Anyway, Theodore Arlington is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. He has been an expert witness in over 40 voting rights cases in the United States and Canada. And he's frequently cited in the press. We checked that out. Yes, indeed, he is frequently cited in the press. Let me just check our time here. We'll have, incidentally, Bernie Sanders talking about taxing, putting a 70% tax on millionaires. Let me see what we can find here. We have Clarence Page hid somewhere in, I'm not sure where he is. No. Yeah, let's see. We may have to put Mr. Page, as sometimes we do, on I guess we'll put him on the week that was. Well, let's get this little one in here right very quickly here. There's a bill. This is from CNN on the 25th of January. It's been sitting on the desktop here. An Oklahoma bill would revoke a teacher's certificate if they walk out of protest. Obviously a violation of the Constitution. as nationwide wave of teacher strikes keep gaining momentum. An Oklahoma bill would make it illegal for teachers to walk out in protest. This would be House Bill 2214. Doesn't stop there. It would also permanently revoke the certificate of a teacher who broke the rule, preventing them from ever teaching in the state again. The bill's office, somebody called Todd Russ, said the main point was to make sure kids don't suffer. And he lied. Students deserve to be in a classroom learning and preparing. What different teacher strike happened when battling a school board, said Alyssa Priest, president of the Oklahoma Education Association. During a strike, teachers usually protest while they are supposed to be in school. But with last year's walkout, many teachers told their administrators they would be absent, and this forced school districts to cancel classes since they wouldn't have enough educators. And because many schools were closed, teachers could protest at the state capitol without punishment. Much like an air traffic controller operator of a school, other union groups are not allowed to strike based on safety or the well-being of third parties. The teachers union also understands when the House Bill 1017 passed in 1990, it would be illegal for them to strike again because it disrupted classes. Thus, the reason for new language. The new bill states it should be illegal for a Board of Education school district employee to strike or threaten to strike or otherwise close schools and interfere with the school operation. Means of resolving differences with the Board of Education, State Department of Education. Teachers Association leader said that she thinks the bill is retaliation for the 9-day strike. Priest said students didn't miss much education because some districts missed the days, added the missed days at the end of the year. Before the walkout, some veteran teachers had worked about 10 years to crack $40,000 to support their families. The fight wasn't about raises, though. The teachers wanted more school funding as high school students read from textbooks as old as they are. So that means the textbooks are 15 years or more. Sometimes the 70 students had to share 25 books. This is unconscionable. Shortly before the teachers were supposed to walk out, the governor at the time, Mary Phelan, signed a deal that would give them some but not all of what they wanted. The deal wasn't enough. The Oklahoma Education Association did not deliver a single dime of value about the pay package we've already delivered before the strike. This is from this character, his revision of history. So much more effective way for teachers to voice their concerns is that this is just a waste of time. Contacting your legislatures wouldn't make anything there. Incidentally, down in Birmingham, Alabama, while we were here, that Birmingham Institute re-invited the freedom fighter Angela Davis. They denied her the award put up by a group of Zionists in Birmingham. She, of course, had not responded. This was the Fred Shuttlesworth Award. She was a member of Fred Shuttlesworth. She is from Birmingham. Angela is. Follow up the board. Public apology to Ms. Davis has said immediately after the public apology, in keeping with commitment to learning from its mistakes and in order to stay true to Founder's mission, the board voted to reaffirm Dr. Davis as the recipient. So I guess maybe she doesn't really have to show up there. She'll still get an award. Is a daughter of Birmingham, is highly regarded throughout the world as a human rights activist, no doubt about that. Said the president and CEO of the Andrea Taylor. In fact, the Schlesinger Library at Harvard's Radcliffe Institute of Advanced Studies acquired her personal archives, I didn't know that, in 2018, recognizing her significance in the movement for human rights, her involvement in raising issues of feminism, as well as her leadership in campaigns against mass incarceration. Reverend Thomas Wilder, he's the interim chair, said at the end of the day, we stand for open and honest dialogue on issues, and it is only through our ability to talk openly and honestly with one another's perspectives that we look to move forward the Institute's legacy and foster dialogue. And goes on to say, to accurately reach the Institute's doubling the number of visitors by 2020, this is what the Institute wants to do, promote the success of a newly designed Civil Rights National Memorial to facilitate superb programming, and hopefully they'll bring Angela there. This is from Alabama.com, and we'll put it up here later on our Facebook. And let me see what else we can conjure up. Oh, we'll go ahead and do the sports, and what we're going to do here is we will wait a minute, let me get this poll in very quickly. This is from WDIV, Detroit News poll. Trump faces uphill re-election fight in the state of Michigan. Now, this is DJ Trump's uphill battle in the state of Michigan. The poll released found the blue wave of 2018 continues, motivated to vote at higher levels in Michigan. Voters blame Trump for the shutdown. Michigan voters oppose funding of the wall by 21 points, a 10-point drop in Michigan voters who have put the country on the right track. The motivation to vote in 2020 election amongst Michigan voters is higher than ever. That is according to the Glenn Graf Group, a 10% scale. Voters say they are motivated to move. Drop in national right track. Today, 55.7% of Michigan now views the nation on the wrong track. 86.1% of African American voters believe it's on the wrong track. Michigan voters are optimistic about the state. And Whitmire, who is the governor there, by a margin of 40.5 to 19.7, voters have a favorable opinion of Governor Whitmire. And European voters are split 40-40 on viewing him favorably compared to 46 viewing him unfavorably. This is DJ Trump. By a margin of 36.5 to 53.3. Michigan voters have an unfavorable opinion of DJ Trump. And I don't know if we have, we don't hear. Or here's some of the matchups. This is four hypothetical matchups in the state of Michigan. Joe Biden leads 53.3% to 40.3% over DJ Trump. 5% of voters are not decided. Kamala Harris at 46.6%, and she's at 42, very close race between her and DJ Trump, with 9% there. Bernie Sanders, 52%.